Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to do Obadiah chapter 1, which is the only chapter in the book, and its title, which I will give to it, is Edom Will Be Humbled. Some introductory matter first, miscellaneous information. Obadiah is the shortest book in the Old Testament. The theme of Obadiah is pretty easy to discern. Edom is going to get whacked because of their evil attitudes toward Israel. Now, the author Obadiah is unknown. Nothing at all is known of his life. The word, the name, means servant or worshiper of Yahweh. Now, the date of Obadiah is very difficult to know. There's nothing in the heading or introduction of the book to pinpoint the date. Two alternative dates have been suggested by the scholars. A late date, 586 BC, the date of the destruction of Israel by Babylon, or right before that date, and then an early date, somewhere around 845 BC. We'll start with arguments for the early date first. Argument number one, the vividness of the events described in verses 11 through 14 fit most naturally into the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 BC. And I must say, as I was going through this chapter, when I hit verses 11 through 14, I immediately said, oh, that sounds like the Babylonian invasion of Jerusalem. Argument number two for the late date, around 586 BC, Edom was hostile to Judah at this time, notoriously so, but on the other hand, Edom was hostile a lot of times during the history of Edom and Israel, so that's not a definitive argument. Argument number three, Obadiah is closely related to Jeremiah 49, verses 7 through 16, which prophesies doom upon Edom. And we know that Jeremiah wrote right at about the time of Judah's fall to Babylon, right before that. And so Obadiah could have borrowed from Jeremiah at that time. But on the other hand, Jeremiah could have borrowed from Obadiah, who had written earlier about another destruction of Edom, and Jeremiah just borrowed from it to describe what was going to happen in 586. So that argument is not definitive either. Argument number four. There's a reference in verse 19 to possessing Ephraim and Samaria, which of course refers to the northern 10 tribes. Let me read verse 19, chapter 1. Then those of the Negev will possess the mountain of Esau, and those of the Shephelah, the Philistine plain. Also possess the territory of Ephraim and the territory of Samaria. Now Ephraim, of course, is the name of the northern 10 tribes. It was the largest province of the northern 10 tribes, and Samaria was the capital city of Ephraim. So now, how is verse 19 used as an argument in favor of the late date, around 586? Well, it's because Obadiah says, possess the territory of Ephraim and the territory of Samaria, and the early date, around 845, Israel already possessed Ephraim and Samaria, so why would Obadiah be saying, go possess something you already possess? Before the Assyrian exile in 722, Ephraim and Samaria belonged to Israel. So, again, on the early date theory, why would Israel be asked to possess something they already owned? Therefore, the late date makes more sense to say possess territory that you don't own. Now, early date advocates could argue against that and say, well, Ephraim and Samaria didn't even exist at the late date, around 586, because Assyria had wiped them out in 722, so Obadiah must be referring to an earlier time when they did exist. Therefore, the earlier date is true. Late date advocates might respond to that by saying, well, Obadiah in 586 or so could be referring to the former lands of Ephraim they were to be possessed again after the return from Babylon, maybe under the Maccabees at some point in the future. So we see the arguments there are somewhat inconclusive. We go now to the fifth argument in favor of the late date theory, and this is my favorite argument. The mention of exiles in verse 20 is logical if the Assyrian and Babylonian exile had already taken place. And of course, the Assyrian and Babylonian exile had not taken place in circa 845 BC, the early date theory. So let's look at these exiles mentioned in Obadiah 1 verse 20. The exiles of the Israelites who are in Halah and who are among the Canaanites as far as Zarephath, as well as the exiles of Jerusalem who are in Sepharad, will possess the cities of the Negev. So exiles are mentioned twice. The exiles of the northern Israelites who were in Halah, that probably refers to somewhere in Media, northern Persia, and who were among the Canaanites as far as Zarephath near Sidon. That's where the Assyrians scattered the northern Israelites in 722. And then the exiles of Jerusalem, I mentioned at the end of verse 20, the exiles of Jerusalem who were in Sepharad, that's Sardis, will possess the cities of the Negev. So that argues for a late date, because it was only at the late date that the exiles existed. The exiles are the two major exiles in the history of Israel, 722 and 586. But the early date advocates can answer that by saying, well, exiles can refer to individuals who were deported before 722 and before 586. So you see, the arguments are somewhat inconclusive. Well, let's look at arguments for the early date, which, as I said, is around 845 BC. Argument number one. The events described by Obadiah fit naturally with the revolt of Edom against Judah, as well as the Philistine and Arabian attack against Judah and Jerusalem during the time of Jehoram. He was the king of Judah between 848 and 841. So let's read this key scripture here in 2 Kings 8:20, verse 22. During Jehoram's reign, that's 848 to 841, Edom rebelled against Judah's control and appointed their own king. So Jehoram crossed over to Zaire with all his chariots. Then at night he set out to attack the Edomites who had surrounded him and the chariot commanders, but his troops fled to their tents. So Edom is still in rebellion against Judah's control today. Well, Jehoram ruled between 848 and 841, and so if this is what Obadiah is talking about, that fits right well with around 845, the early date. Argument number two. There is some evidence to indicate that Jeremiah borrowed from Obadiah's prophecy. In other words, Obadiah didn't borrow from Jeremiah, because if Obadiah borrowed from Jeremiah, then Obadiah would be writing at a late date, because that's when Jeremiah was writing, right before 586. But there is some evidence to indicate that it was the other way around. Jeremiah borrowed from Obadiah's prophecy, Obadiah prophesying at an earlier date, and Jeremiah prophesying at a later date. Well, there's no way to prove who borrowed from whom, so that argument number two is inconclusive. Argument number three for the early date. Obadiah 20 speaks of a deportation to Zarephath and Sepharad, which is Sardis in Asia Minor. But the Jews were deported rather to Babylon in 586. Well, this is an argument from silence. The argument would go like this. Well, if Obadiah meant to say that a deportation to Babylon was meant, that deportation to Babylon would have been mentioned, but he didn't mention it, therefore it didn't happen. It's an argument from silence, and those arguments are generally sort of weak. This deportation mentioned to Zarephath and Sepharad, Sardis, could have been during Jehoram's reign, 848 to 841. We just don't know about it. So that's a weak argument in favor of the early date, mentioning verse 20's exile to Zarephath and Sepharad, saying, well, see there, it's not Babylon, so therefore it must be the early date. No, that's not going to work. Argument number four, Obadiah's account does not mention things one would expect if the late date were true. For example, Obadiah doesn't talk about the destruction of the temple, the raising of the city walls, the deportation to Babylon, the name of Nebuchadnezzar. Again, that's an argument from silence. Just because he doesn't mention it doesn't mean it didn't happen. I have an article by Hampton Keithley who brings up three other arguments for the early date, but I'm tired of this. You see that it's a complicated issue. It doesn't really matter. Now, since this chapter is all about God's anger toward the Edomites, let's take a look at the history of relations between Edom and Israel. We're going to start around 300 or 400 years after Esau was born. He was born about 1850 BC, although that date is controversial. The date's kind of fuzzy. When he lost his birthright to Jacob, about 300 or 400 years after that, when the Israelites were on their journey from Egypt to Canaan, the Israelites ran into trouble with Edom. And we're going to assume the early date, around 1454, I think it is, mid-15th century, that's about 400 years later. The Edomites would not let the Israelites pass through their territory. We read in Numbers 20, verses 14 through 21. Moses sent messengers from Kadesh to the king of Edom. This is what your brother Israel says. You know all the hardships that have overtaken us. Our fathers went down to Egypt, and we lived in Egypt many years. But the Egyptians treated us and our fathers badly. When we cried out to the Lord, he heard our voice, sent an angel, and brought us out of Egypt. Now look, we are in Kadesh, that's Kadesh Barnea, a city on the border of your territory. Please let us travel through your land. We won't travel through any field or vineyard or drink any well water. We will travel the king's highway. We won't turn to the right or the left until we have traveled through your territory. But Edom answered him, "You must not travel through our land, or we will come out and confront you with the sword." "We will go on the main road," the Israelites replied to the Edomites, "and if we or our herds drink your water, we will pay its price. There will be no problem. Only let us travel through on foot." Yet Edom insisted, "You must not travel through." And they came out to confront them with a large force of heavily armed people. Edom refused to allow Israel to travel through their territory, and Israel turned away from them. And that was not a good career move on the part of the Edomites. God's trying to set up his chosen people in the land of Canaan, and the Edomites obstreperously tried to stop the Israelites. About 400 years later, in the time of King David, who ruled from 1010 to 970 in the nation of Israel, we read this in 2 Samuel 8, verses 13 through 14. David made a reputation for himself when he returned from striking down 18,000 Edomites in the Valley of Salt. He placed garrisons throughout Edom, and all the Edomites were subject to David. The Lord made David victorious wherever he went. The Valley of Salt is down south of the Dead Sea. That's where the Edomites were. So David conquered the Edomites. We move ahead now to about 870 to 848, the reign of Jehoshaphat. 2 Chronicles 20, verses 22 through 23. The moment they began their shouts and praises, the Lord set an ambush against the Ammonites, Moabites, and the inhabitants of Mount Seir. And Mount Seir, of course, is that mountain range that runs north to south at the eastern edge of the Dead Sea. And that, of course, at the southern end of that range is Edom. And so the Edomites are called the inhabitants of Mount Seir. So the Lord set an ambush against the Ammonites, Moabites, and Edomites against Judah, who had come to fight against Judah, and they were defeated. The Ammonites and Moabites turned against the inhabitants of Mount Seir and completely annihilated them. When they had finished with the inhabitants of Seir, they helped destroy each other. This is when Jehoshaphat sent out his army with the praisers in front, and there was friendly fire and wiped out the Edomites. In the next reign, Jehoram's reign, 848 to 841, we see that the Edomites revolted from under the dominion of Judah. In 2 Kings 8:20, during Jehoram's reign, he was the king of Judah, 848 to 841. During Jehoram's reign, Edom rebelled against Judah's control and appointed their own king. Now, during Amaziah's reign, which is 796 to 667, we read this. In 2 Chronicles 25:11, Amaziah strengthened his position and led his people to the Valley of Salt. He struck down 10,000 Seirites. So you see, constant struggle with the Edomites. We drop ahead now to 732. Ahaz begins his reign between 732 and 716. And we read this in 2 Chronicles 28:16 through 17. At that time, King Ahaz asked the king of Assyria for help. The Edomites came again, attacked Judah, and took captives. Constant warfare. And Edom famously rejoiced over Jerusalem's destruction in 586 B.C., as we move ahead in time, Psalms 137, verse 7. Remember, Lord, what the Edomites said that day at Jerusalem. Destroy it down to its foundations. Destroy the city of Jerusalem. Lamentations 4, verse 21, Jeremiah says this. So rejoice and be glad, daughter Edom, you resident of the land of Uz. Uz is someplace up there in the desert, east of the Dead Sea, in the Arabian Desert. Yet the cup will pass to you as well, Edom. You will get drunk and expose yourself. In other words, we Israelites have been wiped out by the Babylonians, and we've drunk the cup of suffering, but the cup's going to pass to you as well, Edomites. You're going to get drunk and expose yourself. And of course, the Babylonians then conquered Edom somewhere around 586. Afterwards, the Babylonians themselves were devastated by the Persians in 539, and that's when the Nabataean Empire arose in Edom. The Nabataean Empire, some kind of Arabian empire. They were the ones that started that famous city of Petra, which everybody goes to see now, the United Nations landmark. Well, what happened to the Edomites? Finally, what's the story about the end of the Edomites? Well, during the time of the Maccabees, who started the Hasmonean dynasty, they ruled from 167 to 37. During that time, Edom was annexed with the Jewish state by John Hyrcanus. Hyrcanus was somewhere around 100 B.C. I don't have the dates in front of me. But Edom got annexed, and they were part of the kingdom of Israel. And then the Romans conquered Judea in 63 B.C., conquered Israel in 63 B.C. And at that time, the family of Herod became kings of Israel under the Romans. The family of Herod was Idumean, and Idumean was the current term back then for Edomite. So Herod was an Edomite, and he actually began to rule Israel, but then Israel was destroyed in 70 AD, and there were no more Idumeans. In fact, the Edomeans were one of the three factions in Jerusalem that were destroyed by the Romans in AD 70. And at that time, after that destruction, they disappear from history. So we see from that brief thumbnail sketch of the battles between Edom and Israel that relations between those two nations were not good, and God was angry with Edom. So we begin now in verse 1 of Obadiah, the vision of Obadiah. Thus says the Lord God concerning Edom, we have heard a report from the Lord, and an envoy has been sent among the nations, saying, arise and let us go against her for battle. Now Esau was the father of Edom, and of course the dispute with Esau's twin brother Jacob, also known as Israel, that started with an argument over who would own the birthright from Jacob, but that was a long time ago. In Obadiah's time, the dispute was over trade routes. Trade from Damascus in Syria all the way down to Egypt went through Edom on the eastern side of the Dead Sea, the King's Highway. And so that apparently was a bone of contention, says one of my commentators. Now, at some time, the Edomites had helped enemies of Jerusalem attack Jerusalem, and I'm assuming that's Babylon during the Babylonian captivity. And they used that occasion to take over part of the Negev, which is the southern part of Israel, which butted up against Edom, which was further to the south. So God sends an envoy among the nations. Now this envoy is asking for help to go for battle against the Edomites because the Edomites are going to be destroyed. Now we don't know when this happened. This could just be symbolic. God is calling the nations to go against Edom to destroy Edom. And of course, nations is a good reference to the Babylonian Empire because the Babylonian Empire had a lot of constituent nations which it had conquered, assuming the late date. Well, I guess you could assume the early date of Obadiah was written in the early date, and he's prophesying up into the future about 586. We go now to Obadiah chapter 1, verses 2 through 4. Behold, I will make you small among the nations. You are greatly despised. The arrogance of your heart has deceived you, you who live in the clefts of the rock, in the loftiness of your dwelling place, who say in your heart, who will bring me down to earth? Though you build high like the eagle, though you set your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down, declares the Lord. Now, clefts of the rock are mentioned here. This is where the Edomites are. To get into the more lush areas of Edom, you had to go through narrow rocky terrain on the east side of the Dead Sea. You had to go through the area around Petra, and since I've been there, I can tell you it's very, very rocky. And if the Edomites had holed up in the rocks around Petra, I'll take Petra for an example of one of their fortresses, you've got to go down into Petra one man at a time through the narrow entranceway with the rocks on both sides. That's just how it is now. You can't really run a whole army down there into the stronghold of Petra. One of my commentators said you would have to enter one man at a time, and I don't remember if it was that narrow, but it was narrow. So the Edomites were very secure in their rocky strongholds in the rocks. They're way up high, in the clefts or in the caves, and they say, he will bring me down to earth. I'm high up here like an eagle, because eagles always put their nest way up on the rocks. I set my nest among the stars. The stars are very high in the sky, and that's where my nest is. That's why I'm way up there. And God said, well, I'm going to bring you down. We go to Obadiah 1, verses 5 through 6. Obadiah continues, if thieves came to you, if marauders by night, how ravaged you would be. Wouldn't they steal only what they wanted? If grape pickers came to you, wouldn't they leave some grapes? How Esau will be pillaged, his hidden treasures searched out. Of course, Esau is just the name for Edom, Esau being Edom's ancestor. Now, this idea of thieves coming out, would they steal only what they wanted? Well, yes, they would. They will only take valuables. They're not going to waste their time taking out trash bags and things that aren't valuable. But in contrast to those thieves, the people who are coming after Edom are going to take everything. They're going to take the trash bags and the knickknacks and the things that aren't valuable. They're going to pick you clean. Likewise, if grape pickers came to you, wouldn't they leave some grapes? Yeah, because grape pickers always left grapes to be gleaned by the poor. But the people who are coming after Edom, they're not going to leave any property to the Edomites. They're going to take everything. They're going to strip the land clean like locust. How Esau will be pillaged, his hidden treasures searched out. We go now to verse 7. Obadiah continues, everyone who has a treaty with you will drive you to the border. Everyone at peace with you will deceive and conquer you. Those who eat your bread will set a trap for you. He will be unaware of it. Edom will be unaware of it. Well, who has a treaty with the Edomites? Adam Clark says it's the Babylonians, and since I tend toward the late-date view, let's say it's the Babylonians, they will drive you to the border. In other words, the enemies will drive the Edomites to the edge of their own country, and then out of the security of their own country into the hands of the enemies of the Edomites. They will drive you to the border, i.e. to the border of your own country. Everyone at peace with you will deceive and conquer you. Jameson Fawcett Brown says this refers to the poorer tribes of the desert who subsisted on the bounty of Edom. But they will be false. They will deceive the Edomites, and they will conquer the Edomites. They will be deceived in such a way that the Edomites will not even understand that their own allies were plotting against them. One commentator has said that the reason God conquered the Edomites is because the suffering Israelites, who had been driven into exile by the Babylonians, they might be tempted to emulate the ungodly Edomites because the Edomites were prosperous. Well, God didn't want a bad object lesson for the Israelites, so God told the Israelites through Obadiah that the Edomites were going to go down for their sin. And so that's why we have this Jeremiad against Edom in this one chapter of Obadiah. We go now to Obadiah 1, verses 8 through 10. Obadiah continues, "In that day," this is the Lord's declaration, "will I not eliminate the wise ones of Edom and those who understand from the hill country of Esau? Teman, your warriors will be terrified, so that everyone from the hill country of Esau will be destroyed by slaughter. You will be covered with shame and destroyed forever because of violence done to your brother Jacob. In that day, Esau, Edom, will be destroyed." What day? Gill says it's either of two times. Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Edom right around 586 at the same time that Babylon destroyed Judah. Or it could be when John Hyrcanus destroyed Edom, subordinated and incorporated the Edomites into Israel during Maccabean times. Once Hyrcanus did that, once the Maccabees did that, the Edomites never again were an independent people. And of course, they were eventually destroyed along with Israel in AD 70. So they were destroyed. The prophecy of Edom was fulfilled. The wise ones of Edom will be eliminated. What is this referring to? Well, on the road between Damascus and Egypt, Edom's in between, and there was much intellectual interchange, a lot of cosmopolitan goings on. The Edomites, in fact, were renowned for their wisdom. We read in Jeremiah 49:7, "Concerning Edom, thus says the Lord of hosts, is there no longer any wisdom in Teman? Has good counsel been lost to the prudent? Has their wisdom decayed?" So they are famous for wisdom. Now, Teman is a famous city of Edom. BibleAtlas.org has it about 25 miles south of Petra, with a question mark. That's in the rocky Mount Seir range to the east of the Dead Sea. But nobody knows exactly where it is. It was just a stronghold somewhere in Edom. The wise ones of Edom will be eliminated from the hill country of Esau. That's Mount Seir, the mountain range of Esau, the mountain range of Edom. Teman, your wars will be terrified, in verse 9, so that everyone from the hill country of Esau will be destroyed by slaughter. Verse 10, you will be covered with shame and destroyed forever because of violence done to your brother Jacob. Jacob, of course, is another name for Israel because Jacob, the human Jacob, had another name, Israel. Jacob meant deceiver. Israel meant wrestler with God. And, of course, Jacob, also known as Israel, was the twin brother of Esau, who was the ancestor of Edom. You will be covered with shame because of violence done to Jacob or Israel. There's no need to look for particular cases. The Edomites were always hostile to Israel, as Adam Clark says, and as I mentioned as I went through the history of the conflict between Israel and Edom in the introduction to this chapter. Now, Edom's sins against Israel were made all the more egregiously indefensible is because these sins were done to Esau's brother. Their descendants fought each other, even though they had twin brothers for ancestors. That's why Jacob is called a brother. We go now to Obadiah chapter 1, verses 11 through 14. Obadiah continues, "On the day that you stood aloof, on the day that strangers carried off his wealth, and foreigners entered his gate and cast lots for Jerusalem, you too were as one of them. Do not gloat over your brother's day, the day of his misfortune, and do not rejoice over the sons of Judah and the day of their destruction. Yes, do not boast in the day of their distress. Do not enter the gate of my people in the day of their disaster. Yes, you, do not gloat over their calamity in the day of their disaster, and do not loot their wealth in the day of their disaster." Sort of a repetitious phrase there, the day of their disaster. Do not stand at the fork of the road to cut down their fugitives, and do not imprison their survivors in the day of their distress. Well, in verse 11, strangers carried off the wealth of Edom. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown has some candidates for that, three candidates, and these candidates are not necessarily exclusive of one another. Option number one, Philistines and Arabians in the reign of Jehoram of Judah, who ruled between 848 and 841. They were strangers, these Philistines, these Arabians. They carried off the wealth of Israel. We read about that in 2 Chronicles 21, verse 16. The Lord put it into the mind of the Philistines and the Arabs who lived near the Cushites to attack Jehoram, Jehoram of Judah. Now, who these Arabians were that lived near the Ethiopians, I don't know. There were Arabs everywhere in the desert, even south of Egypt, along the Red Sea, and the Philistines on the southwest of Israel, where current-day Gaza is. And in that day, strangers carried off the wealth of Jerusalem. When Obadiah says strangers carried off his wealth, the his there refers to Jerusalem. Foreigners entered his gate, the his stands for Jerusalem, and cast lots for Jerusalem. Jerusalem is explicitly mentioned finally in describing what the foreigners did to Jerusalem. Well, option number one is the Philistines and the Arabians in the time of Judah as people who cast lots for Jerusalem and entered Jerusalem's gates. Option number two, Syrians in the reign of Joash, king of Judah. He ruled between 835 and 796. We read about that in 2 Chronicles 24, 24. Although the Aramean army is Syrian army, although the Aramean army came with only a few men, the Lord handed over a vast army to them because the people of Judah had abandoned Yahweh, the God of their ancestors. So they executed judgment on Joash. So the Syrians whipped up on Joash. Another example of foreigners entering into the gate of Jerusalem. And of course, the Babylonians entered into the gate of Jerusalem in 586 BC. This, of course, is one of the arguments for the late date, is that this description here sure sounds like the Babylonian captivity, which would mean that Obadiah wrote his book somewhere around that captivity. But again, there are other candidates, so again, the arguments are not conclusive. Well, these foreigners, strangers carrying off the wealth of Judah, are not the Edomites. It's just that the Edomites were rejoicing over the fact that the enemies of Jerusalem were beating the Israelites. Well, this is probably when the Edomites were rejoicing over the Babylonians, burning the city down, burning the city of Jerusalem to the ground. And Obadiah says, don't gloat over that. Don't gloat over your brothers. That's Israel's day, the day of his misfortune, I'm assuming 586. Do not rejoice over the sons of Judah in the day of their destruction, and do not boast in the day of their distress. That was such a horrible disaster. It seems that that's what Obadiah would be talking about, not a raid of foreigners in the time of Jehoram or the time of Joash. Nobody remembers that, but everybody remembers what happened in 586. So we see the Edomites are gloating over the calamity of the Jews and looting their wealth. They even stood at the fork of the road to cut down their fugitives. So as the Jews are trying to escape Jerusalem, as the city is burning, the Jews are running, and the Edomites stand there and say, nope, you're not going here to escape. Do not imprison their survivors in the day of their distress. The Jews are running, terrified out of the burning city of Jerusalem, and the Edomites grab them and restrain them and imprison them. Now going back to verse 11, when foreigners, not the Edomites, but either the Babylonians, the Philistines, the Arabians, or the Syrians, whoever is being referred to here by Obadiah, they cast lots for Jerusalem. Well, we read in Joel chapter 3, verse 3, which was talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, they have also cast lots for my people, traded a boy for a harlot, and sold a girl for wine that they may drink. Traded a boy for a harlot means they took a Jewish boy that they had captured and then sold him for a price and then bought the service of a harlot for the price of the boy. Likewise, sold a Jewish girl as a slave for the price of a drink of wine. And the Edomites are just gloating about it. Ha, ha, ha. Little bit of schadenfreude on the part of the Edomites, but God's going to get them for that. We go now to Obadiah 1, verses 15 through 16. For the day of the Lord draws near on all the nations. As you have done, it will be done to you. Your dealings will return on your own head. Because just as you drank on my holy mountain, all the nations will drink continually. They will drink and swallow, or stagger, as the NASB Brackett say, they will drink and swallow or stagger and become as if they had never existed. Now, in verse 15, we have the day of the Lord drawing near on all the nations. Now, that phrase, day of the Lord, is used everywhere in the Old Testament. It's always a day of judgment. What day of the Lord is being referred to here? Well, the futurists say this is the second coming of Christ drawing near on all the nations, but I think rather it's some fulfillment that occurs in historical times. In other words, all the nations could have been clobbered by the Babylonians, for example, the Philistines, the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Syrians, the Phoenicians, the Jews. The Babylonians come and wipe them out. That could be the day of the Lord that's being referred to here. Now, let me make a point here about how dispensational futurists handle a lot of prophecy. They will admit sometimes that prophets are speaking about historical fulfillments, but then they say, well, but the prophecy is doubly fulfilled. They're near fulfillments, which are historical, and then the far fulfillment refers to the second coming of Christ. And they do that over and over again without proof, I might add. And I really don't like that procedure. I think the prophets were aiming at one thing. Now, they might have been aiming at a historical fulfillment that is then used as a type for something, but I don't believe it's a type of the future millennium. The types are usually talking about the first coming of Jesus. But, of course, none of that is provable. It's just an assumption that one has to make one way or the other. Now, at the end of verse 15, God promises Edom that as whatever Edom had done, the same thing was going to be done to Edom. As you have done, it will be done to you. This reminds us of the verse in Genesis 12, verse 3, when Abraham was leaving Haran, going into Shechem for the first time to visit the promised land. God tells Abraham, "And I will bless those who bless you, Abraham, and the one who curses you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed." So the one who curses you, I will curse. That's very similar to what God is saying through Obadiah in Obadiah 1:15. As you have done, Edom, it will be done to you. You've cursed my nation of Jews, and you're going to be cursed. Now, verse 16 presents us with a little bit of a problem, because just as you drank on my holy nation, all the nations will drink continually. The question is what does this mean, drinking on the holy mountain? That's Zion in Jerusalem. Who's drinking there? Well, Charles Ellicott says that the question is perplexed, but I'm going to give you three options. Option number one, Edom is drinking in triumph after defeating Jerusalem. Option number two, Edom is drinking the cup of vengeance for what they did on Mount Zion. Edom is drinking, in other words, the cup of the wrath of God. So option number one, Edom is happy drinking. Option number two, Edom is unhappy drinking. Option number three, it's not the Edomites that are addressed, it's the Jews that are addressed. Because just as you drank in happiness and feasting and in joy, because just as you drank on my holy mountain of Zion, all the nations will drink continually, and of course they're going to be drinking judgment. Well, let's look at these options. Option number one, Edom is drinking in triumph after defeating Jerusalem. Ellicott holds this view, as does Kyle and Delitzsch. And so Edom is drinking in happiness, and then the other pagan nations that defeated Edom will drink also. Because it says, because just as you drank on my holy mountain, all the nations will drink continually. So you got you, the Edomites, drinking on Mount Zion after they defeat Jerusalem. And I think that might be symbolic, because I don't think Edom actually conquered Jerusalem. But they're drinking triumphantly on Mount Zion, and then all the other nations are drinking the cup of the wrath of God. Barnes says that they'll be drinking from a cup of wrath. However, you might say it's possible their drinking will also be in triumph. In other words, the Edomites drink in triumph on Zion because they beat Israel, and all the other nations will drink continually in triumph as they conquer, but then they will swallow and become as if they had never existed, and then God will turn on them and destroy them. Well, that's option number one, Edom drinking in triumph after defeating Jerusalem. So say Ellicott and Kyle and Delitzsch. Option number two, Edom is drinking the cup of vengeance for what they did on Mount Zion, and then all the rest of the nations will drink the cup of vengeance also, and then they will be destroyed. That's the easiest interpretation, because you don't switch from Edom drinking in triumph to all the other nations drinking judgment. It's more parallel. So I think that's the option I like the best. Now, option number three, that it's the Jews that are drinking on Mount Zion. Well, the advantage of that position is that you don't have to worry about how Edom got on Mount Zion to be drinking. The Jews are there. It's their country. They're drinking on Mount Zion, and then the other nation drink the cup of God's wrath. So the Jews are drinking the cup of God's wrath, and other nations are drinking the cup of God's wrath. Now, these other nations of God were used to punish the Jews, but they were nevertheless evil nations that God desired to punish. For example, the Philistines, the Moabites, the Ammonites, and the Edomites. Their names are not heard of in the world anymore. The problem with this view that Adam Clark holds, as well as some other commentators, that it's the Jews who are being referred to as drinking the cup of God's wrath, it's awkward, and this is the problem, it's awkward to make Obadiah turn from addressing Edom to Judah, as Ellicott, the pulpit commentator, point out. The whole chapter is about judgment on Edom, and all of a sudden we have this reference to Judah thrown in. It's out of context. It violates the context of the chapter. Judah is addressed nowhere else in this prophecy, as Ellicott and Kyle and Delitzsch point out. And so why all of a sudden would Obadiah be talking about Judah? And I think those arguments are persuasive. So I'm just going to take this difficult verse as saying that Edom is drinking on the holy mountain. This is just a symbol. They're drinking because they won. They're drinking in victory. And then the other nations are drinking the cup of the wrath of God because God will destroy them for destroying Jerusalem. We go now to Obadiah 1, verse 17. But there will be a deliverance on Mount Zion, and it will be holy. The house of Jacob will dispossess those who dispossess them. Now, what is this deliverance on Mount Zion? Of course, Mount Zion is a symbol of Jerusalem, or a symbol of the whole nation of Israel. Sometimes it's northern Israel. Sometimes it's just Judah. Sometimes it's the whole nation. But what's this deliverance? And incidentally, in the New Testament, Mount Zion stands for the Church of Christ. Well, when is this deliverance on Mount Zion? Well, here's some alternatives. The futurists say it refers to the end of the world. Some people say it's returned from the Babylonian captivity from about 538 or so B.C. Some people say it's Israel defeating the Maccabees in the 2nd century B.C., starting in about 167, when they beat the Seleucids. And some people say it's the church. And, of course, you can always say there's an historical fulfillment, such as return from Babylon or defeating the Maccabees, and that is a type of the new Mount Zion, the one that's mentioned in Hebrews 12, the heavenly Jerusalem, Mount Zion, the church. That's what's really being talked about here, is a fulfillment of the type. The house of Jacob will dispossess those who dispossess them. Well, that could be physical possessions. When the Jews returning from Babylonia, or when the Jews, after defeating the Maccabees, get the property back. But Adam Clark says it could refer to the restoration under the gospel in the New Covenant age. We go now to Obadiah 1, verse 18. Then the house of Jacob will be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame. But the house of Esau will be a stubble, and they will set them on fire and consume them, so that there will be no survivor of the house of Esau, for the Lord has spoken. So fire is going to consume Edom. Esau, of course, is Edom. And there will be no survivor. In other words, Edom is going to be totally wiped out. Now, that happened under the Maccabees. The Israelites reduced the Edomites into slavery, obliged them to receive circumcision, forced them to practice the rites of the Jewish religion. That can be read about in 1st and 2nd Maccabees in the Apocrypha, and also Josephus writes about it. Or it could be when the Edomites are finally wiped out, when they are enveloped in the nation of Israel, starting with Herod. There were Edomites in the city of Jerusalem when the Romans came in AD 70. But they all got wiped out in AD 70. So whatever it took place, the Edomites did get completely wiped out. Burn up. Burnt like stubble, which burns very, very fast. We go now to Obadiah 1, verses 19 through 21, and we will finish this chapter.
Obadiah continues, Then those of the Negev will possess the mountain of Esau, and those of the Shephelah, the Philistine plain, also possess the territory of Ephraim and the territory of Samaria, and Benjamin will possess Gilead. And the exiles of this host of the sons of Israel, who are among the Canaanites as far as Zarephath, and the exiles of Jerusalem, who are in Sepharad, will possess the cities of the Negev. The deliverers will ascend Mount Zion to judge the mountain of Esau, and the kingdom will be the Lord's. Now, this is a prophecy of how Zion is going to conquer the various areas of Israel that are mentioned. Many people take this as a type of the conquering of the new Zion, the new Israel, over the Gentile world as the Gentile world becomes converted to Christ. And therefore, the verse ends up on verse 21, and the kingdom will be the Lord's. Well, let's go through the individual geographical areas mentioned here first, and we'll discuss that later. and we'll discuss the fulfillment of this prophecy later. Verse 19, then those of the Negev. The Negev, of course, is the desert in the southern part of Israel, down there toward Beersheba, Eilat, at the southernmost tip of Israel. Those of the Negev will possess the mountain of Esau. And, of course, the Negev is closest to the kingdom of Esau, which is to the south of the Negev, and further east to the south of the Dead Sea, and on further east to the south of Moab. So we see lands contiguous to Edom being in charge of occupying Edom, and those are the Shephelah, the Philistine plain. The Shephelah is the plain to the southwest of Israel, where the famous five Philistine cities were. Israelites are going to bump out the Philistines there. Also possess the territory of Ephraim and the territory of Samaria. Now we go north of Jerusalem to the major tribe to the north of Benjamin. Benjamin and Judah were Judah, and then north of Benjamin is the tribe of Ephraim and its capital city of Samaria. The Jews are going to have that territory too. So we're going from south to southwest to north. And Benjamin will possess Gilead. Benjamin, of course, is right north of Jerusalem. You go east across the Jordan River and you get to Gilead, which is the territory that runs from the southern tip of the Sea of Galilee to the northern tip of the Dead Sea. Benjamin will possess Gilead. And so here we see poetic justice. Israel will totally subdue their long-term tormentors. We continue, verse 20. Exiles of Israel who were among the Canaanites as far as Zarephath. Zarephath is that famous city where the widow of Zarephath was. It's near Sidon, which is right up the Mediterranean coast from Tyre, which is right up the Mediterranean coast from Haifa, that city in northwestern Israel near Mount Carmel. 1 Kings 17:9, get up, go to Zarephath that belongs to Sidon and stay there. Look, I have commanded a woman who is a widow to provide for you there, the famous widow of Zarephath. So exiles were there in Zarephath, and then we've got exiles from Jerusalem who are in Sepharad. Now, where is Sepharad? It's the famous city of Sardis in Asia Minor. It was the capital of the Lydian Empire in the 6th century BC before the Persians got it. Later, it became a center of Hellenistic and Byzantine culture. I read an interesting article on Sepharad. Some archaeologist found an inscription in Sardis written in two languages, and I forgot which two languages they were, but one of the languages had Sepharad and the other language had Sardis, proving thus that Sepharad was Sardis. And that's a long way from Israel. There were exiles there. So the idea is that all of Israel will be occupied by Jews, and even exiles far away from Jerusalem are going to come back to Jerusalem. This is the same theme of return to Zion that is often used by all the prophets, both major and minor, to show that Israel will be possessed by Jews, which is a type of the church coming in to the new Zion, Jews and Gentiles coming into the Christian church. Now let's go into this in a little bit more detail. The Jews will possess the territory of Ephraim and Samaria. Alexander the Great gave Samaria to the Jews. He ruled from 336 BC to 323, but he gave Samaria to the Jews, and then John Hyrcanus, the Maccabean, subdued Samaria after his war with the Seleucid Empire. This is all in Josephus. And so we could say, well, it was fulfilled then. Obadiah's prophecy was when Samaria was taken over by the Maccabees. Now, why does Obadiah say that Benjamin will possess Gilead? This is what Joseph Benson says about this. Benjamin, although one of the smallest tribes, shall enlarge his borders as far as the land of Gilead beyond Jordan. Here a larger possession is promised than ever they had before the captivity. But if Judah be considered as united with Benjamin, which perhaps it is, as those two tribes made but one people, all this was completely fulfilled in the time of Hyrcanus, as appears from Josephus. But no doubt the great enlargement of the Church of Christ in the times of the Gospel is mystically pointed out in this passage. Mystically means it's a type. Mystically has bad connotations. He's an old commentator. So Benjamin is mentioned all by himself because he's really a part of Judah, and Judah is a part of Israel that's conquering Edom. And of course, Edom is a type of all the nations that have opposed Israel because Edom has always been opposed to Israel, as have other many nations also, including the Hamas butchers who are trying to destroy Israel now, as I speak, after the attack on Israel on October the 7th, 2023. Now let's mention the fulfillment again in verse 19. All these particular places that are being possessed. This is what Guzik, the dispensationalist, says. Israel never possessed Edom, so this possession will happen sometime in the future. That's what futurists do. They always jerk prophecies out of their historic context and push the fulfillment all the way out into the future where I cannot examine the truth or falsity of the dispensationalist statement. But let me ask Mr. Guzik something. Why do you say that Israel never possessed Edom? Israel conquered Edom under Hyrcanus, the Maccabean. Hyrcanus ruled from 135 or 134 BC to 104 during the Maccabean period. So why could that not have been a fulfillment of the prophecy? Let me give you another hint at fulfillment. Benjamin shall take Gilead in verse 19. So the Jews returning to Israel were to expand and even go across the river of Jordan. This area was formerly possessed by the half-tribe of Manasseh. Well, when did this overflowing of the Jordan River to take control of Gilead happen? John Gill says that some think that this was fulfilled in the times of the Maccabees, when several of these places in Gilead were taken by Judas Maccabee. This is described in the apocryphal book, 1 Maccabees chapter 5. So once again, we see the Maccabean period as being a historical fulfillment of this prophecy in Obadiah. Verse 21, the deliverers will ascend Mount Zion to judge the mountain of Esau. Will ascend Mount Zion. That sounds a little poetic and symbolic to me. The deliverers of the old Zion will ascend Mount Zion to judge Edom. If Edom is an emblem of all the pagan nations who oppose God, and if the deliverers are an emblem of the believers in Jesus who ascend Mount Zion, then at the end of verse 21, the kingdom will be the Lord's. Now, one might ask, Dan, how do you know that this is what Obadiah is talking about? I mean, he could have just been talking about the fact that the Maccabees under Hyrcanus took over the country and beat Edom. Why do you say that this prophecy is fulfilled under Jesus the Messiah in the Church of Jesus Christ? Well, I can't prove it, but I must say I do have good company. I'm going to read you the list of commentators I had that said point blank, unequivocally, that Obadiah was talking about the church as the fulfillment of this prophecy. Jameson Fawcett and Brown, Matthew Henry, John Gill, Colin Delitch, Kaufman, Albert Barnes, Joseph Benson, Charles Ellicott, Matthew Poole, the pulpit commentary. Let me read you what Kyle and Delitch say. The fulfillment of Obadiah 1, verses 17 through 21, can only belong to the Messianic times. Sounds like Kyle and Delitch aren't even happy with the idea that the Maccabees fulfilled this prophecy partially. The fulfillment can only belong to the Messianic times, and that in such a way that it commenced with the founding of the kingdom of Christ on the earth, advances with its extension among all nations, and will terminate in a complete fulfillment at the second coming of our Lord. Even this phrase, at the very end of Obadiah, verse 21, and the kingdom will be the Lord's, listen to how that phrase is used in the scriptures, Revelation 11:15. Then the seventh angel sounded, and there were loud voices in heaven, saying, the kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he will reign forever and ever. The kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of the Lord. That's John the Revelator. This is Obadiah. The kingdom will be the Lord's. That terminology is quite similar. Psalms 22, verse 28, for the kingdom is the Lord's, and he rules over the nations. Well, let me give you the full range of options as to how Obadiah might be fulfilled. I've already told you the main option is fulfilled under Jesus in the church. But Adam Clark mentions that the fulfillment could be the restoration of the Jewish state under Zerubbabel and Joshua, the priest, upon the return of the Jewish exiles from Babylon, circa 538. Well, even if that's true, Clark nonetheless still allows a secondary fulfillment in the church. In other words, the return from Babylon is a type of what happened in the church. I prefer type to secondary fulfillment. And then, of course, there's the option that this prophecy is fulfilled when the Jews were restored under the Maccabees in the 2nd century B.C. Kyle and Delitch denies that, although other commentators that I read have mentioned as I went through here like that interpretation. And of course, the fourth possibility is all this is going to be fulfilled in a Jewish millennium sometime far off in the future. Now, I look for a dispensationalist who might say that. That's something a dispensationalist would typically say. I went to Guzik who is a dispensationalist, and he didn't say that. So I don't know how strong dispensationalists are on that interpretation. But at any rate, I think we leave the book of Obadiah with a sense of gratitude and joy, really, that the Church of Jesus Christ is victorious. You want some eschatology that will encourage you instead of all the doom and gloom, the black helicopters, the nuclear bombs of Tim LaHaye and Hal Lindsey. You want some encouragement? Think about these Old Testament prophecies that talk about the kingdom of God spreading over all the earth. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished the book of Obadiah, the one chapter of Obadiah. In our next audio, we will take up the book of Jonah. We'll go through the famous story of Jonah and the great fish, the four chapters of that book. And I hope you stay tuned with me as we do that, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.